All right, welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge, Silent Film, the ones and twos. We are back, and we're excited about another episode. Today's special guest, Enquirer attorney, the best First Amendment attorney in America. Obviously, there's only one First Amendment, and it's only in America. So,
In the world.
Jack Greiner. So looking forward to having Jack on. It's cold, it's snowy, but we're here in our studio, and you're fresh off. Every time I click on Cincinnati.com, you've got a new story up. And but the one thing I wanted to talk to you about today was your latest story on, you had a really nice piece on Cincinnati Election 101. Talk about that and what went into that.
You know, honestly, I almost didn't write it because it's like, well, it's the basics of how city elections work. However, I got so many questions on Twitter and people were emailing me asking some questions. It's almost like we forgot the process. It's been four, as I put in the headline, in parentheses, long years since the last election. And there are actually some changes because the council races are going back to two-year terms. And so I just kind of just did this primer of like how this all works. I mean, I've said this here before and you're going to hear me say it all year long. This is the most important election that this city has had in 100 years. It is a complete changing of the guard at City Hall almost. I think that we might see some of these council people come back, but it's just not for a decade. It's been the same people in office in partly because of how term limits changed and things like that. And partly these people were known and really loved leading up to what happened last year. And so we're a new mayor. Then the way we choose the council, this field race of nine. And with a new mayor, you get a new city manager. You get a new city solicitor for the most part. It will be interesting to see because the current city solicitor, Andrew Garth, has kind of risen through the ranks of just being like a city attorney. And so it's going to look awfully different next year. And people are being asked to make those choices. Right now, the mayor filing deadline is Thursday of this week at 4 p.m., everybody who said they're running is not in that race yet. PG Sittenfeld, so there's a lot of, you know, last minute things that we're looking for. Jason and I will talk about next week, right?
Yeah.
let's let that sort itself out.
I think it's pretty settled for the most part in terms of the key people being in Mann, Aftab, Pureval, David Mann, Cecil Thomas, maybe a few other, Wendell Young maybe getting in too, but to me, I see it as those are the three main candidates that are going to really strongly compete for in this May primary to move on, in the field race to move on. The top two finishers move on to the November election.
The story talks about that.
Yes, it does.
And how that all works. And, you know, even though I think one of the number one questions I got is that, yes, there's two. It narrows to two in the primary. However, you only vote for one, and then the top two vote-getters kind of move forward. And so it's really this very big decision come May. And then council will have time after that if people are going to get in based on who that might be. We see some shuffling after that maybe. But it starts really getting, you know, set.
Yes, it does.
Now.
How many potential council candidates could there be?
85 people have pulled petitions.
85?
85. Not all those people will run and then more might run, right? And so I feel very comfortable saying that this is the largest field of candidates that we have ever had.
Probably about 40 of them will run, about half, I would think.
I actually think more than that.
Really?
I mean, people are very serious. Because I have a list out there online. I'm updating that now. So people, please look for that of people who are very serious about this and out there getting signatures and starting to raise money. So I think this is actually going to be a bigger field race than normal. And of course, I mean, we already have six candidates in the mayoral race, and that is just unprecedented.
Yeah, and just one more thing before we jump over to our guest today is First Amendment attorney, our attorney here at the Enquirer, Jack Greiner. It's crazy to think that only one current council member who was on the ballot in 2017, will be on the ballot again this year, and that's Greg Landsman, the Democrat, who is just finishing his first term on the council. So he's – if you would just finish your first four-year term, are you now eligible to run for two more – because we moved to two-year terms.
Correct.
As well.
Two-year. He can run for two-year terms, I
for
believe.
For two-year terms, so a total of 8 years.
Correct.
If he is elected all the time. Okay, cool. We'll be following your coverage on this. Sherry, is what a big year it is here in the city of Cincinnati with, like you said, the changing of the guard, new mayor, an entirely new council. Gonna be fun to keep tabs on it. Let's jump over. Bring on Jack Greiner. Special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. Pleased to welcome one of our own, the best First Amendment attorney in America. I guess you have to say America because only America has the First Amendment.
All right.
And the Inquirer's lawyer for many, many years, Jack Greiner. Jack, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. Appreciate the kind words. I'm not sure I agree with the assessment, but I appreciate it.
I should mention also that you're the managing partner at Graydon Law.
Yes.
And you also are the author of the Jack Out of the Box blog, in which we run your blog entries on Cincinnati.com. So,
do you know what I call him in the Coolidge house? You ready? Jack, I don't think I've mentioned this. the wind beneath my wings. And also, we call you Big Jack because we have a little Jack. And I do reference you in Coolidge House conversations. And so you've had to become Big Jack. That's how often we talk about you.
I call you Big Jack, too. And we don't have any Jacks in our family. So, but I still call you that.
Hey, yeah. Well, I would like you to tell my two sons who are, you know, respectively 6'2 and 6'3. And do not always refer to me as Big Jack, but I'll take it.
Okay, so, I mean, obviously I've known you, like, from day one since I started at the Inquirer, but you have been the Inquirer's attorney going back to 1995, and I kind of want to talk about how you got into First Amendment law, thankfully, yeah, for all of us.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I didn't go to law school with that really in mind. I think I always wanted to be in court and do trials, but I really didn't get much more specific than that. And when I got out of law school, I did have the opportunity to do work on some trials, some jury trials, which were a lot of fun. But in 1995, Larry Beaupre was the editor of the Enquirer, and for several reasons, he decided that he wanted to make a switch from the previous counsel that the Enquirer had been using. And we got an opportunity to participate in kind of a pitch. They sometimes call that a beauty contest, but if it were really a beauty contest, there's no way I would have won that. But we went over, and, you know, we just kind of ourselves and a couple of other firms kind of, you know, pitched why the Enquirer should use us. And I really didn't have that much First Amendment experience at all. I had just a sliver of a couple of things that I had done. And I was really the only person in our firm who had any kind of experience. So that's why I got to go make the pitch. And I tell people, I think that I won over Larry with my enthusiasm and not with my experience, because I didn't have any really experience, but I did have a lot of enthusiasm. And I told him that, and I meant this when I said it, that this is the reason lawyers go to law school, to work on this type of, you know, these types of things, First Amendment and public access to records. I mean, it's just such a privilege to be able to do that. And I knew it would be a great fit, or a great thing to do. And I also felt, you know, just I've always been way more interested in words than numbers. And so the idea of, you know, representing reporters like the two of you and, you know, the bigger entity, the paper, I just knew that was going to be something that I would love. And I have absolutely loved it for 25, going on 26 years now. So kind of amazing.
So, I mean, I want to get right down to it. I mean, let's talk about, I mean, you have made case law that has just helped the public in so many ways. Like, I joke when I say the wind beneath my wings, because that is not what you do. You make public records accessible to the public. And so they can know the information that is pertinent to their lives and important to everything around them. And that is what this is really about. So let's do a greatest hits.
Well, okay. And I don't do that. I gather the facts, I research the law, and I make arguments. And, you know, ultimately it's up to the courts to do the right thing. And you know, honestly, it is amazing to me how the Enquirer has continued to be aggressive in these types of things and allow me to, you know, go to court, make the arguments, because a lot of newspapers and other media outlets have just sort of not, because, you know, it's expensive and it's time consuming. And, you know, the Enquirer, I think, really stands out in their willingness to fight these fights and, you know, fortunately use me to help. But, you know, I think one of the early greatest hits, Sherry, was the one you and I worked on, and that was the lead paint issue. It led to a story called Lead's Dangerous Legacy. And, you know, it was just that I think is really illustrative of how these cases work. The city had an obligation to inspect. So if a kid under the age of like 6 years old went to any doctor in the city and there was an elevated lead content in that child's blood, there was an obligation to report it to the city health department. And then the health department reported it to the city, and the city was obligated to send out inspectors to that child's house, school, and daycare center to see, you know, if there was lead paint there, and to abate it if there was. And you, through some digging, you know, found that the city was a little lax in that regard. And
Didn't want to tell us, did they?
We wanted to get the reports, and they came back and said that they couldn't give us those reports because it would reveal the identity of the kids, and it would reveal information protected by the federal HIPAA law. We challenged that. We went all the way to the Supreme Court of Ohio, and it was interesting because there were two things. First, we said, look, we're not asking for the name of the kid.
Right.
We want to know the daycare center. We want to know the school. And we want to know, you know, if they're in an apartment complex, for example, what apartment complex. But we really weren't looking for the name of the kid. We didn't want that. We didn't need that. So we challenged the logic of the city, saying that somehow, you know, if some kid at, I don't know, St. Mary's School in Hyde Park, you know, tested positive, well, that, and that's all we knew, that would not identify that kid at all. So we challenged it on factual grounds, but then we challenged it on legal grounds, because when we looked at the HIPAA regulations, and it said, you know, this information is private unless it has to be produced, you know, under state law. And so we said, well, the Ohio state law actually says that medical records are exempt under the Public Records Act, but only if they're generated in the course of treatment. And these records weren't, you know, we weren't talking about the underlying treatment by the doctor. We were talking about the abatement orders and whether it had been abated. So in fact, the state law superseded HIPAA, and that was actually the first case in the country, where that was examined. And we prevailed and, you know, found some pretty damning information. I think it led to, both city and state amendments to legislation to protect kids. So, you know, I felt really good about what we did there, and I think it really does kind of illustrate the point. You know, we were also lucky enough to Getty involved with the first case that dealt with whether dashboard camera footage would be produced. The Ohio Highway Patrol.
This is when body cams were just a glimmer in everyone's eyes, and that wasn't even a thing yet. Dash cam was the thing. And right. They were turned at scenes, like people wanted to see what was unfolding. It's very, yes. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that was interesting because there was a chase on I-71, a high speed chase, and you know I don't know if there were any associated wrecks or whatever, but they, you know, they finally pulled this guy over and you know made the arrest, and we wanted to see the footage because it went over a pretty long period of time and a pretty long distance. And the highway patrol said, no, that was investigatory material. We were kind of like, wait a minute. All we want is what was on your camera while you were chasing this guy. That is not an investigation. That is a chase. And by the way, Ohio Highway Patrol, you've got a YouTube channel where you put chases on your YouTube channel. So it seems a little questionable that that's an investigatory record that needs to, you know, be confidential. We took that to the Ohio Supreme Court, and Justice Judy French, who's no longer on the court, wrote a really good opinion, you know, that went our way, saying, yeah, it's not investigatory. And I think we had three different Ohio Highway Patrol cruisers that were involved in the chase, all of whom had their dash cam running throughout the chase. I mean, we had, you know, several hours worth of footage, and the court said the Highway Patrol could withhold only, I think, like 2 minutes of footage where they actually took the driver into the cruiser and read him his rights and took his statement. She said, well, okay, that's investigatory, but everything leading up to that, you know, is not investigatory. So, again, I think that sort of set the tone for, you know, for dashboard camera footage. Now, I will say that the day we argued that case in the Supreme Court, we also had a body camera footage case from the Tenzing case up in the Supreme Court. So I had to argue two cases in the Supreme Court back to back. They kind of decided on a little, I'm trying to remember the technicality. They didn't give us the body camera footage. I'm drawing a blank on just exactly what the technical ruling was on that. But I have to say, I will say that, so I argued those two cases back to back, and it was about an hour's worth of argument because you get about a half an hour for each case. And I was exhausted.
With the justices asking tough questions, you have to think on your feet. You can't just prepare for these kind of things. Like, yeah. You're there in the moment. I'm fresh off of P.G. Sittenfeld's motion to dismiss hearing yesterday. And I mean, I felt like that was exhausting because it's not, you're not preparing and here's what's going to happen. And you kind of know a judge can ask anything.
Anything, you know, and it was really, I will tell you, I walked away from there. I ran the first three Flying Pig marathons, and I was as tired after that experience with the Supreme Court as I was, I think, after each of the marathons. I was just whipped. I just took a nap. I mean, I was just exhausted.
Jack, speaking of exhausted, like some entities and government agencies are incredibly difficult to deal with, I think more so than others. And I'm not asking you to comment on this, but I will say I think University of Cincinnati Council has been pretty notorious for being difficult with public records. I don't know how it is now, but I remember you and I, when I was on loan to sports, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, working on the Big 12 flirtation with UC, and we worked together on that. Is that – well, I guess what I want to ask you was, does that make your job – that much more difficult when there are certain entities that are really good about it and certain ones that aren't? Or run into that typically? Like, oh, when you hear like, oh, this is it, when Sherry calls you and says, oh, we got a case or we're working on this and the department or something is mentioned, do you just automatically think, oh, yeah, those folks are always difficult to deal with? Or
you know, I'm kind of an optimist by nature, so I tend to think, you know, we'll be able to you know, work this out if we can. And the other thing I'll say, so I don't, you know, I don't think that lawyers are, you know, superheroes that can just get what they want no matter what. I don't think that about myself. I don't think about lawyers. And I quite frankly don't really like clients who think that. I think that, you know, at the end of the day, it's the facts and the law. And I think, you know, Sherry can tell you that there are situations where I'll say, yeah, Sherry, they're right. That exemption applies. And, you know, we're not going to be able to get that record. And we're not going to go fight a futile battle to get it. David Pepper one time, I consider this one of the best compliments I ever got. He said, Jack, you know, having dealt with you, we know that if you're pushing, then there's probably a pretty good chance that record is a public record. Cause you know, we trust that you've made the judgment before you start, you know, shooting. And I really try to do that. I also have tried to develop relationships. One of the best things that ever happened to me was when John Kerp, a number of years ago, got the job as the law director for the city of Cincinnati. He came down from Columbus and he reached out to me and just said, Jack, I know what you do. I respect what you do. Just anytime you've got an issue with the city, will you please call me? And let's see if we can, you know, resolve it. And we did in many cases, not every case. We had some litigation against the city, but when John left and Paul Boggs-Muthing took that job, she and I tried to, you know, have that same kind of relationship. I feel like I've got it with Andrew now, the current law director. And, you know, again, with UC, I know some people in that law department, and, you know, I really do try at the outset just to have that conversation and not just, you know, fire right out of the gate. Cause I think, you know, if you can develop relationships and you can develop some mutual respect and trust, that's in everybody's best interest.
I'm just, you know, I can think of the handful of times I've worked with you before I became a columnist, you know, on the CVG airport stuff or with, you know, your firm and the Big 12 stuff. And, it was us, UC on the Tenzing thing. I worked, Amber Hunt and I did a lot of work on that. And it led to, and you were the leader of this. It led to us winning a First Amendment award in the Ohio APME awards. I don't know, what was that, 5 years ago or so? But I love the fight, and I love the core mission of it is that these are the public's documents. They're not yours, Mr. and Mrs. Politician or public official. These are the public's.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, I've never been able to totally understand when we've gotten in some fights where it seems pretty obvious that we ought to get the record. The sort of the proprietary approach that some people take, which is exactly contrary to what it's supposed to be. That you know, there's a Supreme Court decision where the Ohio Supreme Court said, you know, the public does not come like a serf to the master with their hat in the hand. You know, these are the public's records, and you know, I think the really conscientious public officials recognize that, but some, you know, take that very proprietary attitude, and it becomes very adversarial. And you know, it really shouldn't. And I think there's that proprietary sense. There's also, I think, a paternalistic sense that we run into sometimes, which is frustrating, which is the public, you know, it's like, you can't handle the truth, you know, to quote A Few Good Men. And it's kind of like, well, I think we probably can. And I don't think you're giving the public enough credit. We've run into that, with just access to courtrooms, quite honestly. In the Tenzing trial, we had to fight for access, and this concern that, you know, if we identified, even not by name, if we had a picture showing the jurors, you know, that, my God, they were going to be subject to some sort of terrible, you know, retribution or whatever. And I just, I don't think that's typically the case. I don't think that was the case in the Tenzing trial, but I think we had to deal with that attitude from some folks up at the courthouse that was rather frustrating.
How has social media changed your job? You know, we hear Twitter, Facebook saying they are free speech platforms, and yet they'll turn around and they're banning people for life. Obviously, we saw that with Donald Trump. The politics of whoever aside, but from a First Amendment standpoint, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, it's really not a First Amendment issue because these are private entities and they can enforce their code, you know, their rules of conduct. So it is not a First Amendment issue. Twitter and Facebook, you know, can enforce those rules. Having said that, you know, I do worry a little bit about whether those rules of conduct are applied consistently or arbitrarily. But you know, Trump's just such a special case because I do think that you know, a repeated barrage of false information. You know, I'm not sure it's good for the First Amendment that has a platform. And you know, that probably sounds a little more political than we really want to get. I don't want to go down too far that hole. But yeah. I mean, I do think that the post-election stuff with saying it was rigged and saying it was stolen and all that was just not good for our democracy. And it, you know, it did lead to, you know, people storming the Capitol. And so, you know, the First Amendment does have its limits. And, you know, speech that incites violence and, you know, is not protected by the First Amendment. And certain false speech is not protected by the First Amendment. Some is and some isn't. There was a case a few years ago where the Supreme Court, you know, threw out the Stolen Valor Act. That was a piece of legislation that the Congress passed that made it a crime to lie about military service. And the, you know, the Supreme Court said, no, that's unconstitutional. That is a violation of the First Amendment. Just the idea of lying. I mean, now if you lie to commit a fraud or if you lie to incite a violent mob, that's a little bit different. But, you know, the idea of just lying, in fact, there is a First Amendment protection for false speech.
I kind of do want to ask this before we have to go, because this is the number one question I'm getting right now. These, you know, cases in federal court are, you know, of great interest to our readership and this city and how it's governed. But yet you cannot have cameras in the federal courthouse. And there's not like really this opportunity too much to live tweet. Can you talk about that a little bit and why that is? And so so our listeners can understand.
Yeah, I think it's just sort of tradition more than anything else. I think there's this sort of, you know, tradition of decorum, I guess, for lack of a better word, in the federal courts. And so, you know, somehow the presence of cameras would, I guess, in the view of, you know, the people that are making the rules, detract from sort of the pomp and circumstance and decorum that is expected in a federal court proceeding. I could not disagree with that more. And there's this ongoing debate about, you know, cameras in the U.S. Supreme Court. And it seems to be this, this evolution of, you know, people get nominated for the Supreme Court and they talk about, oh, you know, I think it'd be great to have cameras so the public can see oral argument. And then they get appointed and it's all of a sudden, yeah, that's not a good idea.
yes.
Change your mind. And the thing that drives me nuts about that argument is that, you know, this notion that lawyers will play to the camera and they'll grandstand and that sort of thing. You know, the Ohio Supreme Court for years, for at least 10 years, probably more, have live streamed oral arguments. So you can go to the Ohio Supreme Court website if there's an oral argument and you can watch it live. They also archive it so you can go back and pull it up and watch it. And I've argued half a dozen times or more in the Ohio Supreme Court live stream. And the last thing on my mind is the fact that I'm on camera. All I care about is looking the justices in the eye, making my points, answering their questions, and doing the very best job I can. You just don't think about the camera, and you just don't. And I think the notion that that's the reason we can't have cameras in the U.S. Supreme Court is just preposterous. And I think the public would really benefit from watching it, live and how it transpires. I think it'd be a humongous public interest, and it just frustrates me to no end that the court won't move forward with that.
Well, hopefully they're listening. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today. I want people to know you like I do and how important your work is. So this was such a good conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, Jack. Well, thanks for everything you do.
I just wanted to say, before I go, I just want to say what a big fan I am of your podcast. I've been, I've really gotten turned on to podcasts through the COVID because I stopped going to the gym and I walk. And so I'm a huge fan. I think I've listened to a lot, not all of them, I suppose, but most of you guys do a great job. And it was just such a thrill to be able to be on with you. So I do appreciate that.
Thanks, Jack. Thanks for all you do for us. And most important for the public here in greater Cincinnati and Ohio. And thanks so much.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you guys.
Bye, Jack.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks again to Jack Greiner for joining us here today. And now we shift gears into the fun segment of the show, our That's So Cincinnati moment of the week, brought to you by Cincinnati.com. Sherry, dun, dun, dun. You got this one.
This is a That's So Cincinnati moment that I'm getting ready to talk about, but it's technically a Batesville, Indiana moment.
A greater Cincinnati region moment.
After hearing about Cherry Thingalings for years, I went out on Saturday. And I have to tell you, it was A, worth the drive, B, worth the wait, 2 hours in a very cold, socially distanced line around Schmidt's Bakery, which once a year makes Cherry Thingalings.
Okay, first of all, what in the hell are Cherry Thingalings?
I have to tell you, I brought you some, and the Coolidge boys ate them. I was like, I was saving those. And they're like, well, you didn't say that. I guess I needed to like specially mark them.
I saw you post about this on Facebook. I saw our news director, Michael Perry, post about it on Facebook. They look delicious. They look like just a lump of red donut-y thing.
They are. They're donuts, apple fritters, but with cherries, and they
like real cherries in them, or like cherry glaze?
Oh no, real cherries.
Okay,
they are just incredible, and they bake for days, getting ready. They're to celebrate President's Day weekend. They are on sale for 3 days, and they've just really become like this mecca towards them. And I have to say, somebody kindly brought me one last year, and it was so good. And then the same person was like, come on, what are you doing? And I was like, what do you mean, what am I doing? It's a snowy Saturday in a pandemic. Nothing.
I'm cozying up on the couch.
Come on. And so we went at the earlier you go, the shorter the line. We went at like the height of the day, which was fine. Honestly, we weren't doing anything, and it was just so fun. And Clem Schmidt, purveyor of Cherry Thingalings, came out, and we were chatting. Nice. I kind of felt like you, because you're just always, you just chat up everybody.
You're too nice to me.
Talking about, what this, doing this in a pandemic was like, honestly, six people in the bakery at a time. But anyway, I feel like, am I a real Cincinnatian now? I don't know.
And is it because of George Washington cherry tree? Okay. I have not.
Yes.
Other than seeing the craze on Facebook and Twitter, I have not read up on them or anything. And I know I hear about it every year. Cherry Thingalings.
Polly Campbell wrote a big story about it in 2011, and we kind of have brought it out like since then, and it was a good story. And she kind of talked about like their growing popularity, but like it's a decade since then, and it is safe to say she predicted that correctly.
So this started a decade ago.
No, I think they were doing it even before then, okay. But she just did a big story back then and just talked about, well, they're growing in popularity, but it's definitely a thing.
It's awesome.
So I'm sorry I didn't bring you any. I'll have to go again next year. Bring
so you,
some you back.
Can't go there now and buy any, right? There, correct. It's done. It's only President's Day weekend every year, special occasion for Cherry Thingalings. But like, it's something they could make year round, right?
Oh, I mean, like of course. Special, I mean, okay. It's a pastry, a baked good. Gotcha. They could do that, but there's
But this is the tradition, yes.
I mean, you know, making a limited edition, there's something that makes it more special.
It's great. Reds baseball is back.
Make
sure you follow Bobby Nightingale's coverage here at The Inquirer, Cincinnati.com. That's pretty so Cincinnati as well.
The season's starting on time, right?
I believe it is, yes.
I saw that.
Pitchers and catchers reported this moment as we're recording.
I mean, let's face it.
Out in Arizona, so
that
it's great.
That is opening day parade or not, which that's still on hold at this point. And we did have Phil Castellini on saying, you know, his kind of take, you know, last summer was he didn't want to do it. If it can't be opening day, like opening day should be, then he wanted to wait.
Yeah.
So, but you know what? Just starting that season and following along, honestly – that is the start of spring in Cincinnati. There's not some date on a calendar that says, today's spring. No, that is spring in Cincinnati when everyone starts following along.
Great stuff, Sherry. Another fun episode. Sitting here, great to be back in the studio with you. Before we jump out, I want to speaking of President's Day, Sherry, I haven't really talked about this lately, but I think we got a great deal right now going on with digital subscriptions. Folks are buying our digital subscriptions like crazy. It's been awesome. Right now, unlimited digital access, $1 for 6 months. That sale ends soon, so you save 98%. Just go to cincinnati.com/subscribe, sign up, log in, and away you go. 24/7, all access to our content, our political content, Sherry's coverage of City Hall, my coverage of all the politics, and Scott Wortman on the county and regional politics, our state house folks, Jesse Ballmer, Jackie Borchardt. We got you all covered. And oh, by the way, we've got all the sports and everything too with Bobby Nightingale out of spring training and our team out there. So check those subscriptions out, and we'll catch you next week.